Welcome, everybody, to Podcasting Them Softly, Episode 8, where I'm here with Nick, co-founder and co-host of Podcasting Them Softly. Right off the bat, before we get into what we're going to discuss, I just want to say a thank you to Gary Young for being our guest last week. And it was incredible. It was a two-hour podcast, but I really enjoyed it. I know Nick did, and we got a lot of good feedback from people. I also want to say that we're going to put something together with Gary for a special podcast that'll be once a month where we'll be discussing two films and comparing and contrasting them. So we're trying to nail down everything, but we're definitely going to do that, and we're going to start that special podcast with discussing Michael Mann's Manhunter and Jonathan Demme's Silence of the Lambs, which is two films that the three of us really love, and we're really looking forward to that. I also wanted to say that down the road, we are going to have other very exciting special guests that are going to join us on our podcast, and Nick and I can't even wait to speak with these people. So it's going to be fantastic. For this week's episode, we're going to be discussing Brad Bird's Tomorrowland, which came out last weekend in theaters. And we're also going to be discussing my feature of the week, Todd Williams' Door in the Floor. So if, Nick, you want to say anything before we...
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, yep. And we're also going to be doing the top five performances of Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger.
Yeah, it goes without saying. Thanks a lot, Gary, for coming on last week. We had a great time, and we're looking forward to this new series that we're going to do with you. And as Frank said, we've got some really cool people getting lined up for the horizon, so we'll see what happens with that. And just can't believe that we've done 8 of these shows, 9 including the Bondcast, and it's been two months of doing this, so I just can't believe that there's been, you know, 9 episodes of this show, so it's been very exciting. Time is flying.
Yeah, it's incredible that it's incredible we've been doing this for, like you said, 9 shows. It's great. I love it. I know you love it, and a lot of people listen to it love it, or the ones we've heard from, so... Yeah, we're going to start off the podcast with discussions on Tomorrowland. Nick, you saw this, did you see it Monday?
I saw it on Monday on my day off, and I know that you're coming in hot, you know, right from the screening, so, you know, jump in, tell me what you thought, and then, you know, I'll let you, you know, as I had a chance to talk about it with you earlier in the week, and, you know, I had a piece, you know, written piece you were able to see a little bit of, but tell me what you thought. Because you just saw it,
right? I took my mom out to dinner and then took her to the movie because I'm such a good son, and we went to go see Tomorrowland. I knew essentially what it was about. I didn't see many previews other than the first teaser that got released a month or two ago, maybe even longer than that. The film stars George Clooney, Britt Robinson, the girl from the CBS show Under the Dome, right? That's her name?
I think it's Britt Robertson, but yep.
Robertson?
Yep.
Oh. And then Hugh Laurie. And it's interesting, and I was looking forward to seeing this because I know you really liked it and Gary liked it and a few other people really liked it. It's gotten mixed reviews. It's at, I don't know, a high 40% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I was really interested in seeing this film because this is what Brad Bird wanted to make as opposed to Star Wars Episode 7, because he was offered a chance to direct that and passed on it to make this film. So my expectations, I wasn't really sure what my expectations were going to be, but I was really intrigued that he would do this over a Star Wars movie, saga movie. I struggled with the movie. The first two acts, I was intrigued by what was going on. I knew what was going on. I knew what the overall message and theme was. When the third act happens and there is a confrontation between Clooney and Hugh Laurie, I loved the third act and I loved how the film ended. the film's beautifully shot, and it looks great. And you have to keep in mind that this is, it's a kid's movie. It's essentially a kid's movie, but it's very adult-oriented with the themes and stuff. I find it hard to believe that a 10-year-old would go into this movie and being like, oh, okay, I get it. Right? Or am I off base here?
Yeah, I completely agree. I'll get into that when I give you my comments, but I completely agree with you.
Okay, good. The film boils down to the two different viewpoints, an optimist and a pessimist, and your worldview. And this is a theme that's been around forever, and you've seen it 100 times, and probably more than 100 times. I mean, I think a lot of things can boil down to those two different viewpoints and the self-struggle that you have with being an optimist or a pessimist or the way you view things. But it's brought to you in this very intriguing way and an interesting way. But I had a hard time being engaged with the film until the third act. I really didn't care about a lot of stuff, and I thought a lot of it was heavy-handed in the beginning. And in the middle, it's like, okay, I get it. Let's get to the part. And then when the third act happens and the confrontation happens between Clooney, the optimist turned pessimist, to his confrontation with Hugh Laurie, who is the idealized pessimist, where they have the confrontation of their views of the world, and they discuss it, and they both, you know, it's interesting because they both bring valid points, and I agree with both of them on their viewpoints of everything. Essentially, the film's about instilling hope and not giving up on making the world a better place, not giving up on yourself. I enjoyed it. When the film was over, I thought to myself that maybe I need to see this again to maybe fully give it another shot. I will watch it again. I don't think I'll go see it in theaters again, but I will probably rent it when it comes out on Blu-ray. I know you like this more than I did. Not that I didn't like it, but convince me of why this movie is very good.
I mean, just based on what you've just said, I would probably say that I liked it a little bit more than you. I don't think that it's great. I think that it has great ideas. I think that it has great style. For me, the least interesting part was the third act, just because it got into the whole talk more than show for me. You're absolutely right. You hit it on the head. It's the optimist versus the pessimist. And I couldn't help but feel that this movie played like a Joe Dante movie or an old school Steven Spielberg Amblin movie, where you have these kids, the British girl playing the, you know, it, I don't really want to spoil it, but the British girl playing, you know, the helper. I thought she was terrific. I think her name is Raffi Cassidy. I thought she stole like the whole movie personally. I really cared about her. I liked her a lot. But this movie is, like you said, who is this movie for? It's too adult for little kids. It's potentially not adult for it's not adult enough for adults. I agree with you. With the overall message about saving the environment and doing good things for our planet, the message is just unbelievably heavy-handed. But again, not that there's a particular problem with being heavy-handed in that particular message, I think, just because, you know, I do think that, you know, we take a giant crap all over our planet every day, and, you know, and I'm to blame as well. I just think that it's one of those things that is a clear problem, and at least there's a movie that's trying to say something beneficial for, you know, for humanity. As a piece of entertainment, I thought it was interesting. There's a lot of sort of questionable elements in a PG movie. I thought there was a surprising amount of death blasting people to, you know, to, you know, smithereens. I thought that the it reminded me of so many different things. It had Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It had Wizard of Oz. Obviously, Epcot Center and Walt Disney are folded into the whole thing through visual motifs and in general notions and ideas about who made up Tomorrowland and who are these great scientists. And, I, you know, the idea that this movie is about promoting knowledge and not stopping the conquest for discovery, you know, those are great themes, I think, that, you know, are resonant at any point for people. And given that America has slowly but surely fallen behind the pack, you know, in terms of technology with other countries, it's a further reminder for people to not stop exploring their, you know, their dreams and passions. It's a unique movie. I mean, it's not based on a pre-existing comic book or toy, and, you know, it's not a movie that you're going to sell lunchboxes over. And it obviously costs, what, $200 million or something like that. And I just think that I think it's a really interesting movie. Certainly as in terms of the summer blockbuster season, and again, not being a sequel or a reboot or a remake, I think it's definitely a bold gamble to throw a movie like this out there. It felt a lot of, to me, it also felt like a live action Pixar movie. And that's not really hard to understand given Brad Bird's, you know, previous background, you know, making Pixar films before he did the, you know, the most recent Mission Impossible film, not the one obviously coming out in a couple months, but Ghost Protocol, which also had an elaborate nature in and of itself. He has an anything goes quality as a filmmaker where you feel like literally anything can happen at any point in one of his movies. And that's always exciting too. So that would be my initial comment, and I definitely, I really enjoyed the interplay between Clooney and Britt Robertson, who I think could be a big star if she gets the right roles. I thought she was very engaging. Couldn't believe that she was 25, found out she's 25 years old, awfully young looking, in my opinion. I thought she was 19. I thought she was like 18 or 19 playing 16 or 17. She's got, you know, they show that she has a license in the movie, but I was shocked to find out that she was 25. So I thought that she just looked very young.
She's supposed to be in high school.
Yeah,
right?
She's supposed to be high school. So she's 25 playing a 16-year-old, you know, which is no major surprise in Hollywood. But there was a lot that I liked. But again, I just thought that the last act sort of got into the standard, let's have people stand around and talk and explain the plot and where we're going. And then it got into a fight, and not that it wasn't interesting visually, because I thought it was some really trippy shit to see in a Disney and a PG movie, the portal and on the beach and opening up. And I love that platform that they were on that was skimming through time during that sequence. I thought that was really neat. Visually speaking, and again, I'm always a sucker for films that have an intoxicating visual style. And this is the guy who shot Life of Pi, Benjamin Button. So the film has Tron Legacy. So the movie just has an amazingly immaculate visual design, which, you know, when somebody knocks it out of the park as much as they do with something like this, even though that I wasn't a giant fan of maybe the last act and some of the things that happened, I'm able to sort of push it aside because I'm sitting there going, holy shit. Even for a movie that was so dominated by CGI, especially coming on the heels of the relatively free CGI of Fury Road. So, which, you know, you can't compare the two movies as overall pieces of cinema because they're so different, but the approach to action and stuff couldn't have been any more different. So,
right. To bring up your point where the film tries to walk the line of being able to explain everything to a younger audience, but also trying to be adult oriented, so adults are engaged with the film and the overall theme and message. That's where I think I have the problem, because I don't think it finds that fine line to walk on.
Yeah, and I would agree with you.
It gets muddled and murky.
Yeah, and I would agree, I would agree with you on that point. I think that it wants. I think that it's a movie where they wanted to have it both ways. They wanted to appeal to kids. They wanted to appeal to adults, and they maybe didn't find that exact through line that you need to have in one of these, you know, type of films. Like, what kid exactly is going to get off on the whole notion of that amazing antique rocket ship that's been buried in between the Eiffel Tower?
Right, that scene was amazing.
It was amazing, and I'm sitting there going,
Clooney's talking about Tesla.
Loved all that stuff, and I'm just terrific. And then, on an action level, I thought that the escape from Clooney's house was amazing.
Yeah, that was good.
Just incredible. The special effects were first rate there, and but again, it involved some, like, you know, doesn't Britt Robertson take like a tire iron to one of those robots like over and over and over again almost?
Yeah, the baseball bat.
Yeah, baseball bat or something. Yeah, so it has this, and that was the you know, that was what reminded me sort of the Joe Dante spirit, you know, that explores, you know, that PG rating that somehow is a little bit sneakier than, you know, than it suggests. But then at the same time, they definitely made concessions for little kids. I guess my biggest question is, what did you think of the scene inside of the comic shop?
That was pretty awesome.
Because I said to myself, I think right after I came out of the theater, I said, Frank's shop got destroyed in the movie. So,
I like that, especially since Disney just acquired Star Wars. So there was tons of Star Wars stuff all over the collectible shop.
All the sound effects when they were blowing up that place and all the laser beams were going off, you could hear R2-D2's noises and you could hear like various sound effects from Star Wars being tossed off in the background. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that was cool. I thoroughly enjoyed that scene, obviously because of all the cool old collectibles that were in that store. But like you said, I almost feel, I don't know if they're going to do a sequel to this. I don't know if it made, if
it won't,
if
yeah,
make
I don't,
enough
I, it won't make enough money.
But I just wish that this film was, well, speaking for me, I wish the film was a little bit more adult oriented. I think, but it's so hard because Disney did it. And I mean, when has Disney really ever done anything? I guess the Tron Legacy is a good example of, that movie's not really for kids. I mean, it's cool and it's flashy. And
yeah, it looks great.
It's got cool special effects, but I mean, that's... And even Tron Legacy's a bit heavy-handed, but I really like the Tron movies, so I kind of don't get caught up with a lot of the dialogue in Tron, but I wish that Tomorrowland was a little bit more like Tron, speaking for myself. And speaking of Tron, before we started recording, I saw that Disney pulled the plug on the third movie, which is very sad. So I don't know if Tomorrowland had an effect on that decision or something like that. But
so no more. So what's his name? What's the guy's name? Because the guy that did Tron in Oblivion.
Yeah. they pulled the plug on Tron 3 after they announced like 2 weeks ago they're going to move forward with it.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. So that's a bummer, man, because I want to see Jeff Bridges in Tron 3.
Interesting.
Like, really bad. I know. That's just kind of bummed me out, man.
Yeah, Joseph Kaczynski's Tron 3 not happening. Interesting. Wow. Well...
Yeah.
On that, with the Jeff Bridges mention, we want to open up the main topic of discussion for today, considering that it was your pick and a damn good one at that.
Absolutely. Our feature film of the week, it's a 2003 independent film, The Door in the Floor, which was directed by Todd Williams. And now that guy goes by Kip Williams, and the only thing he's done post Door on the Floor, I believe, is directed Paranormal Activity 2, which is really interesting.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
But it doesn't make any sense at all, because he wrote the screenplay for The Door on the Floor, too.
He's
a writer-director.
Yeah, I'll get into this after, but it's just shocking.
But anyway, The Door in the Floor is based on a John Irving novel called A Widow for 1 Year, which is a fantastic novel, and it's my favorite Irving novel. The film is only based on the first act of the novel, and the film encompasses the story of a young boy named Eddie, who is played by John Foster, who's Ben Foster's younger brother, and he gets a summer internship with Jeff Bridges, and Jeff Bridges plays Ted Cole, who is a writer who wrote a couple of novels, but becomes a children's author, and he became very successful with his children's books, and his most successful one is called The Door in the Floor. I hate this term, but it's essentially kind of a coming-of-age story of John Foster's character, Eddie, because he thinks he's going to go and stay with Jeff Bridges and learn how to write and study Jeff Bridges and be mentored by him. And Eddie wants to be an aspiring writer. But the film is very tough because the tragedy that's in the film is so heartbreaking and so affecting that it radiates throughout the film and it affects everybody that it touches. Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger are married, and they've been married for a very long time. They do not have a very good relationship. Essentially what happened was probably 15 years prior, maybe a little bit longer, to where the film takes place, Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger had twin sons who died in a car accident. And ever since that happened, that had completely ruined both of their lives. And they both channeled that grief in two separate ways, where Jeff Bridges continued to write children's stories, but wrote stories about Thomas and Timothy, which were the names of their sons that died in the car accident. And he continued on their legacy and channeled his pain by writing these children's novels. As to where Kim Basinger is completely shell-shocked, and in a lot of scenes she is catatonic and can barely move or has zero reaction to what's happening in the scene. They have a young daughter, Ruth, who's played by Elle Fanning, and she's amazing in this. I mean, she's very good in the movie, and she's probably, what, like five?
Yeah, she's...
Maybe?
I think she's a great actress. I think that she's a great actress now. My wife and I, we watched the movie right before we were... Earlier today. It was my second time seeing the film, and I had forgotten that Elle Fanning was in this movie that young, and my wife and I looked at each other and were like, wow, is this girl like just like, you know, there's just some people that clearly were meant to act, and even at five or six or however old she was, she's like incredible in the movie. So
right, so as Eddie enters into this story, what ends up happening is we see Elle Fanning, or we see Ruth, who's Elle Fanning, and Jeff Bridges is the one that takes care of her, and he's the one that's raising her, and he's the one that's sweet, where Kim Basinger is completely withdrawn from her, and it's too painful for her to have another child after the death of their twins. And the movie takes this severely weird turn where Kim Basinger and the character of Eddie begin to have this love affair that's... It's touching and it's sweet until it's not. And it starts to get very heavy and very tragic, because obviously Eddie's in love with Kim Basinger in this film. I mean, how could you not be? Kim Basinger is gorgeous in this film. Just absolutely gorgeous, and she's so fragile that adds to your attraction of her. She's so mysterious, and this is just a very interesting film. I know I say this with almost every film that I select for our film of the week, where I say this is one of my favorite films, but The Door in the Floor truly is one of my favorite films, and I remember watching it And I was so taken aback by it because of how heavy and I don't want to say dark, because it's not necessarily dark, but it's a very heavy and emotional film, and it deals with such tragedy and such broken people. But at the same time, the way it's shot, the way it's shot and the color tones and the beautiful score of the film completely soften the impact of what you're watching on the screen. It's almost as if it's this, well, I mean, essentially it is a melodrama, but I think it gets heavier than almost any melodrama I've ever seen, where it's this very soft, beautiful looking movie. But at the same time, it's so emotionally engaging and so dark. I mean, The Door in the Floor is an interesting title, and I love that title and what it represents. And, you know, particularly the scene in the film where Jeff Bridges reads The Door in the Floor, the children's book, in front of a small audience, which, by the way, the slides that are shown in the film of The Door in the Floor, the animation of the children's book, are drawings Jeff Bridges actually did, which I think is very cool because Jeff Bridges is also an artist and a musician. He's all sorts of things. But the actual story of The Door in the Floor is probably the darkest children's story I've ever heard in my entire life. It's very frightening because what I think this film really comes down to is everybody has their own door in the floor, and that's where everybody keeps all their fears and all their hatred and everything that's bad to them in their own world. And everybody knows what's underneath your door in the floor, and everybody's opened it at some point, and what's down there is terrifying. And I think that this film is a physical manifestation of that. And I think that's why the film strikes such an emotional and personal chord with people who watch it. And I mean, this film goes without saying that if you look on IMDb at the user rating, or if you look on Rotten Tomatoes, it doesn't have a very favorable popular opinion. This is just a film that not many people like. It's not as hated as, say, I Melt With You, but...
Yeah, critics were mixed positive. I was actually taking a look at some reviews after watching it. It got some very favorable reviews. Ebert was a fan, and although he had some reservations, A.O. Scott in the New York Times was a huge fan. But yeah, the response certainly aired more on the 2.5, 3-star rather than the 3.5, 4 that you might think it, this sort of thing would get. And I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
No, you're good. Go ahead.
But yeah, no, I saw this film in the theater. It came out in 2004, correct?
Or 2004, yeah, did I say 2003? Yeah, it's 2004.
Yep, 2000, whenever it came out, you know, earlier in the aughts. And I saw it in the theater, and I remember, and I didn't remember all of it with any amazing clarity before my viewing today, but I did remember liking the film, thinking that Jeff Bridges was extremely, extremely good, that Kim Basinger was very affecting. It's a very... As you said, it's a very intense film. It's a very emotional film. It deals really with internal struggle. Kim Basinger was fantastic. She has always been able to portray vulnerability and inner turmoil, I think, very well. She's always done that very well. And here, like you said, she's catatonic for half the film before that she sort of awakened from her misery by the appearance of this young man. And what I thought was another, just one of the many interesting elements of this film, is how Bridges and Basinger are clearly at the end of their marriage for a variety of reasons. He's ready to move on. He has moved on. I couldn't believe when Mimi Rogers completely took all of her clothes off. I had completely forgotten about the full frontal nudity on the part of Mimi Rogers, who, what, That was 11, was it 11 years ago? So when, how old was she when she made that?
I don't know, but she's older.
Like, in, I just, you just don't see that very often. But I thought that the relationship between Bridges and Basinger was fascinating to watch. His,
oh yeah,
his,
man.
His response, Bridges' response or lack thereof to, and I'm not spoiling anything because they hinted this in the trailer. And you've, as of course you talked about it, the love affair between the, you know, the young student and Basinger, he sort of, not that he doesn't care, but he sort of knows he did it on purpose. You know, he even says it at one point. I brought you here because you look like my, you know, my dead son. I gave you to her is what he says.
Right.
And it's just, there are half a dozen fantastic lines that if they didn't come from the original story, then kudos to Williams for writing them. I do not understand how someone goes from something this patient, adult, serious, demanding, and then it goes and makes, and I know that it didn't do very well. It, you know, wasn't released very wide, but you go and make Paranormal Activity 2, like, 9 years later, or whatever have you, it just doesn't make sense. Either has the world's worst agent, or he doesn't impress people in a room. I mean, I just don't I don't understand how this guy hasn't had more meetings or hasn't gotten a work for hire gig. Like, it just doesn't add up. I noticed.
Right.
I noticed that he's also he married Gretchen Maul. This is a personal thing. I thought that was interesting. He's married to Gretchen Maul, but before that, he was married to someone else for 5 years, and another big actress.
Famke Janssen.
Yeah, Famke Janssen. So very interesting, you know, sounds like a very interesting personal life. But yeah, I just don't understand it. He's clearly a filmmaker of literate intent, and I loved Terry Stacey's cinematography. Just really calm and pretty in a cold, chilly way, in a very New England way. So yeah, it's just a very good film, very good movie, and one that certainly not enough people know about, and you know, and just a further reminder of how great Jeff Bridges is, for God's sake.
Right. Just to touch upon a few things that you said, Todd Williams should be having a Mark Pellington career where he's just directing these stark indie films that are not studio films. I can't believe the guy didn't do that. Like, just start hammering out these indie films, because he would have found an audience. You know, I mean, you and I in particular, and I know a lot of people who listen to our podcast would be huge Todd Williams fans. You know, if the guy just started, like, pounding out indie movies with, Mickey Rourke or Nicolas Cage or a lot of these actors that will go into small indie films that are very personal and are very unique. It's just interesting that he directed Paranormal Activity 2. I don't get it. And then, you know, because the first movie made so much money because it was so cheap to make. And then how does the studio give the guy that directed The Door and the Floor...
Yeah, that's what I don't get.
...a shot at shooting the found footage shit film? I mean, not that they're shit films. I just don't care for found footage. But you know what I mean.
I agree completely. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. And then furthermore about Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger's performances, I can't say enough about either of their performances in this film. They have a few scenes together at the beginning of the film, and it's just genius to cast Jeff Bridges in this role, because Jeff Bridges is an affable person. Everybody loves Jeff Bridges. Everybody loves Jeff Bridges' performances, especially after The Big Lebowski, where he just became this, you know, this pop culture phenomenon. Everybody knows who the dude is. Everybody loves the dude. And I love that Jeff Bridges embraces the dude, but he is also bigger than that. And he can take roles like The Door and the Floor, where it's completely reliant on his affability and how much you like Jeff Bridges as an actor. And as the film kind of progresses, he becomes vicious. And he becomes very frightening with a lot of scenes with Eddie. and the psychological warfare that he engages.
Yeah, and the passive aggressive tendencies.
Right, and I mean, I love the scene with Bridges and Basinger. It's their final scene in the film, where they're together and they don't say anything to one another.
Yeah, at the car. There's no word.
At the car, and wonderful. She just like, right, and she just touches his face, and he embraces the touch like he hasn't been touched by her in 30 years, and they don't have to say anything. That's what's so beautiful about the film. You're watching this film, and you can tell that the tragedy completely broke both. It more than broke their marriage. It broke both of them down to their core and down to their soul. I mean, they're two broken people that have tried to deal with the pain of losing both of their sons the best way they possibly could. And the love that they have for one another is so pure and so amazing that as much as they can hate each other or blame each other for the death of their sons, I think even Kim Basinger says it to Eddie in the film where he's asking her, like, why don't you leave Ted or why are you still here? And she says, because he's the only one that will ever understand what happened to me. And how true is that? And I mean, I can't even imagine what a loss like that would do to a person. But I think at the same time, you would have this inseparable bond with your significant other. You know what I mean? It's the love and the bond between Bridges and Basinger is so strong that in the brief scenes they have together, you can feel it. And I think that speaks volumes of Basinger and Bridges as artists. I think they have completely honed their craft, and they are unbelievable at what they do. And I think the film, as beautifully shot as it is and how beautiful the score is, and it's set in the cold New England setting, and how great the lines of dialogue are and how great Williams' direction is, it's all reliant on Bridges and Basinger in this film.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I mean, what did you think about The Door and the Floor when he's reading the story
the story,
geez,
directly,
man.
Yeah, it's fantastic. The story directly relates to what's the boy's name again?
Eddie,
which, by the way, that's Ben Foster's brother. John Foster. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Eddie is John Foster. Ben Foster, the bigger actor, his brother. He's, mm-hmm. This guy hasn't done anything, and you'd think that if you were in the movie where you were, you know, humping up on Kim Basinger fully naked, you might have gotten a little bit more work afterwards. Not really sure how that hasn't happened for the guy, because he was definitely solid, and
oh right,
and very, you know, very touching at times. Also making some decisions. Obviously, he's a young guy and he's, you know, not thinking upstairs. He's more thinking downstairs. So there was some things that I thought were a little not unbelievable, but just things happen kind of fast. But again, it is what it is. It's a minor quibble, but I thought that really it was one of those movies that is about people. It's about love. It's about sex. It's about the connections that people need in order to feel like they are special and that they're still here on this planet. It has a very upsetting ending when you think about what the future holds for these characters. Not a simple film by any stretch. There was no concession made to make everything tidy and have it wrap up with a bow. And the story, getting back to your initial question, the story that he reads it directly applies to, the kid's relationship to Basinger. And the idea that Bridges knows that it's going on and is going to allow it and accept it because he's invited it. And it's fantastic, honestly. I mean, the story serves its purpose within the story, but the story informs every character and everything that's going on for each character. So it's a further rich element to this movie that, you know, definitely should have had a higher profile. I mean, what were they doing releasing this movie in July? Like, what would give anybody? Didn't this movie come out? I'm almost positive this movie came out in the middle of the summer.
I don't know why this wasn't an award season.
Like,
push.
I don't understand how anyone would have thought to not release this movie in November or December. There's nothing
right
about this movie that is limited release July. Like, when you put out Oscar movies, quote unquote, in the middle of July, is that's because for some reason you don't have any faith in it and that you're just throwing it out there in the hopes that maybe people see it and it gets remembered. Sort of like what happened last year with The Immigrant. But I'm just,
right.
it surprises me because Hollywood, they commission these scripts. All of these people read them supposedly, or maybe not, these executives. You get these performances from great actors, and then you don't promote the film, you don't release it, you let it sit there and die and make $6 million, and I just don't understand the purpose or the point of doing such a thing. You know, these studios should only be investing in movies that they give a shit about, that they feel they can make some money for themselves, yeah, but what is the point of doing this type of film? And this happens all the time. Every year there's 50 movies that are like this one that don't get the attention they deserve because someone's too lazy to figure out how to sell it. And, you know, again, how do you sell a film that's about a crumbling marriage that deals with the death of...
Well, you sell it on Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger giving tour de force performances.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like if this movie was made now or something, I feel like this movie could have been sold so much better because you have Bridges and Basinger giving two soul-bearing performances that are just absolutely fantastic. It's based on a John Irving novel. I mean, come on. The guy wrote Cider House Rules.
I know, and the Cider House Rules was a big hit as far as I remember.
Right.
Like, did he make 50 or 60 million bucks or something? I mean, like...
Yeah, and Michael Caine won Best Supporting Actor for it, and John Irving won the Oscar for screenplay because he adapted his own novel into a screenplay. I mean... And that wasn't that far away from, you know, The Door and the Floor being made, because I feel like the only reason The Door and the Floor got made was from the success of Cider House Rules.
Yeah.
Essentially being, all right, let's get another John Irving novel out here that's deep and heavy and people will love. It's just, it's very interesting to me that this film just was, this is a forgotten film, bottom line. I mean, I consider this film to be in the top 10 of the previous decade. That's how much I absolutely love it and think it's significant to the art of filmmaking.
Yeah, and if you thought that Jeff Bridges rocked a robe to end all robes in The Big Lebowski, my God, the robe that he wears in The Door and the Floor, it's just like, it's incredible the way that he's constantly tying it off and picking it up and moving it around. The scene where he plays racquetball, what's he playing?
Squash.
Yeah, squash. When he's playing squash in that robe, I laughed out loud. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. They're going to go this, and I don't want to spoil everything, but the casual nudity, how he just like whips his clothes, like when he meets the kid for the first time.
He takes a shower, right.
It's so funny. It's like the best icebreaker. It's like, where can you go from there? There's like not much else left. So
the costume design is fantastic. Like his robe and then his floppy hat that he's wearing throughout the film too, like that gigantic sun hat.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Where I love that scene where he's drunk and he's riding his bicycle,
yeah,
and he's just like, he's swerving and he's got his floppy hat and the robe.
Yep.
And I'm just thinking to myself, it's like, how does that not get caught in the gears or anything like that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I will say though, that I loved this film upon my first viewing, and I knew I loved it, and I knew it was something that was incredibly special and unique. And then the end happened. The final scene of this film.
Yeah, we don't want to spoil it. Yeah.
No, I'm not going to spoil it, but yeah. I mean, this is one of the best final scenes I've ever seen.
Yeah, I love it.
And it completely cuts right through you. And as soon as it's over, you're just like, oh. And you just start to, everything, I just feel like everything starts to come together. And all the pieces get put together, and you start to register everything you've just seen. I know you haven't read the novel, but it's very interesting that this film is only the first act of the novel, which I love that this is just the first act of the novel, because the novel is really about Ruth and how she grows up to be a writer, and she's the main character of the novel. And the second act and the third act is her as an adult, and it's her dealing with her father, who is an alcoholic womanizer, which Jeff Bridges is in the film. And then her also struggling with the fact of not knowing what happened to her mother, and also dealing with having grown up in the shadow of her two brothers that are dead. Because throughout the entire film, Jeff Bridges is carrying Elle Fanning around to pictures that the only pictures art that's in the home are pictures of the two dead brothers. And it's essentially them from when they were, you know, toddlers to when they were teenagers before they died. And it's Jeff Bridges carrying her, Elle Fanning, around, you know, explaining what's happening in this picture or what's happening in that picture. It's just, it's very morbid. And it's just, oh man, I hope everybody who listens to this just, I'm sure this is going to be hard to find. I don't know if it's still in print or not. You said you got it from Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix sent the DVD. So they must.
I know it's not on Blu-ray, which is unfortunate. I hope Kino or somebody puts it out on Blu-ray. That would be great, or Twilight Time or somebody. But I just feel like this is a forgotten classic, or you know, it's a forgotten piece of art that not many people have seen. Because I know you told me you saw it in the theater, and when we brought it up last week, Gary said he saw it on video a long time ago when it first came out, and they still made videos. this is, you know, if you like Jeff Bridges and you like Kim Basinger, you just need to see this film. Because
I agree. I mean,
this
I went.
Showcases. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say I went to see it because I was of the fact that it was a Jeff Bridges movie, and when I was living in L.A., I saw pretty much every movie that came out at least once. So I definitely was interested in this just because of the fact that Bridges has always been one of my favorite actors. Maybe this is a good time to segue into our top five, because we could definitely probably talk a fair amount about him considering how much we love. He's just always been one of my favorite actors, and when we take on this task, which can seem very daunting, about picking five performances that are the best or your favorite, it really truly came down for me on Bridges to go with my favorites rather than trying to figure out what is his best, because he's one of those actors for me that has really never been bad in anything, at least that I can think of. And looking at his credits, you know, a couple days ago when I was putting my list together, I was really hard pressed to find one movie where he was actively bad in it. There's so many films of his that I loved overall as pieces of art, and his performance has been a big reason for that. So without further ado, I'll do my top five. And of course, because I'm a glutton for Bridges, I'm going to go with a tie for number five, with Starman and with Francis Ford Coppola's Tucker, The Man in His Dream. Starman and Tucker were both films that my father showed to me when I was growing up, when I was younger. Both made huge impressions on me. Both movies feature Bridges in really different performances. Starman, he's an alien coming to help out a woman who's grieving over the loss of her husband. And Tucker, it's a classic American story of a guy with an idea, in this case, an automobile. And I love both films. He conveys very different things in both of these movies, but it was very hard for me not to put both of them on my list, so I had to go with a tie. Number four is his performance in Mark Pellington's Arlington Road. This is a political thriller that I have been obsessed with since seeing it at a test screening back in the day. It came out in 1999. Another film that is just, for me, not a July film. It should have come out in October or November. It sits pretty close, for me, pretty close to the Parallax View in terms of a modern political thriller that is truly unnerving and offers up some genuinely scary and plausible ideas, even if the ending is contrived to make a massive wallop of a statement. I still love that ending. For me, it's one of the best movie endings. It's right up there with The Game and Fight Club and Seven and some of those great movies that really just kick your ass in the final moments. And Bridges playing the paranoid college professor who's convinced that his neighbor, played by Tim Robbins, is a domestic terrorist. I just love the performance. It's sweaty. It's paranoid. He's nervous. He's not in control. And I just thought he was fantastic in the film. And again, I've long been just totally consumed by it. I've watched it how many times. It's one of my favorite political thrillers. Number three, Peter Weir's Fearless. This is a movie that absolutely blew me away when I was younger, has continued to blow me away throughout the years. One of the great plane crash survival movies. The plane crash sequence in that film is very impressionistic, very intense. He plays a man who survives, one of the few survivors of a horrific plane accident, who basically begins to feel that he's God and that nothing can, you know, version of God and nothing that can happen to him. I'm going to walk across the street and not get hit by a car. I'm going to eat a bowl of strawberries when I've been told I can die from my allergic reaction to them, and going to change the way I live and how I see the world. And I just, for me, it's a 4-star movie. I've loved it forever. And I think his performance is just overwhelmingly emotional in that film. Number two, and again, this is just strictly my favorite performances. Number two is going to be Rod Lurie's The Contender, because he played just the greatest president that we could ever possibly imagine having, you know, asking for shark sandwiches. I will still always laugh about that.
One of my favorite lines in that film, when everything comes to a head at the end of the movie, and he tells the one character, "Well, you fucked up, buddy."
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah.
I absolutely agree. He is so good in The Contender, a movie that I love. Big fan of that film for a while. I wish that would get a Blu-ray release. But yeah, just a really, really fun performance playing a president who decides to nominate a female vice president for his ticket. And
who's still, not Sarah Palin.
Yes.
Not
Sarah Palin.
Just want to throw that out there.
The film is filled with great performances from a lot of people. Gary Oldman is this major scene stealer there. Obviously, Joan Allen, terrific in the lead. But Bridges really just awesome in that movie. And my number one, without question, my favorite performance of his is definitely The Big Lebowski. It's just that movie, I've watched it so many times. Just like so many other people, I've memorized it front and back. It's very hard for me to look at him and not see the dude or a version of the dude. One of my favorite all-time scenes in any movie is towards the mid to late portion of The Big Lebowski, where Philip Seymour Hoffman has tracked him down and he's in the limousine and he's stoned and like half cocked and he's got his jelly sandals on and they're yelling at him about fucking up and he just has nothing to say and he stumbles over his words. And it's just, I just absolutely love that movie. And I love his performance in it. And just going into Vaughn's at, you know, midnight and opening up that creamer and like taking a sip and writing a check for 67 cents or whatever it is. He's so fucking good in that movie. And I'll never not see him. And again, you know, I don't want to go crazy because I want you to do your top five, but you could go in so many different ways with him. I mean, he's done action films, he's done westerns, he's done comedy. He's been around for, 40 years. So I'll kick it over to you.
All right. Before I get into my top five, I just wanted to say that Jeff Bridges is my number two actor of all time. That's how much I love him. He's right behind Daniel Day-Lewis, who's my number one of all time. But I talked to Nick earlier in the day, and I told him that I'm like, man, I can't come up with a top five Jeff Bridges performances. This is just too hard, because everything this guy's been in, whether or not the movie is that good, he is always amazing. A perfect example, it's sitting and I can't see it on my coffee table, but a good example of that is, what the hell's the movie with Tommy Lee Jones? Blow Up? Help me out here.
Blown Away. I love that movie.
Blown Away. I don't think that's the best movie.
No.
But I love that film because of him and Tommy Lee Jones. And
exactly.
I think they're two fantastic actors. I mean.
And it has the greatest explosion probably ever in cinema history in that Boston boat, that boat that explodes
right
at the end. I mean, it's just.
Yeah.
It's still one of the greatest explosions ever.
Man, I love Jeff Bridges so much. I love his art. I own both of his albums. He released one prior to Crazy Heart, that was digital. I bought that one. And then after Crazy Heart came out and the masses saw Jeff Bridges singing, they're like, oh, Jeff Bridges is a musician. And it's like, yeah, he's a musician. And I have his album on vinyl that he released after Crazy Heart. You know, that ludicrous, sleep tape, Super Bowl commercial was, you know, where he released his own like sleep tapes, like, this is going to help you sleep. And I remember I saw that and I knew it was coming because I had read about it prior, and I got so excited. And when the sleep tapes got released, I mean, you can listen to it free, not on his website, but you can get directed to it from his personal website on whatever website it's on. I bought a cassette of it, and then I bought the vinyl. And it's not even going to help you sleep, man. There's some tracks on there that'll be good sleep aids, but it's just so psychedelic and weird. And I feel like it's a perfect encompassment of who Jeff Bridges is as a person, because I think he's such a fascinating person and he's such a inspiring person. But anyway, I'll stop the gush over Jeff Bridges and I will get into my top five of his. My number five is Arlington Road, Mark Pellington's Arlington Road, the guy that directed I Melt With You. I love his performance in that. I've rewatched it a couple of times over the past couple of weeks. I love the film, and you're spot on when you say it's a modern-day Parallax View, because it totally is. And there's, you know, the film opens with him carrying this kid that, like, blew up his hand down the road and taking him to the hospital. And, you know, every time I think of that film, I think of Jeff Bridges in the hospital and he's like all sweaty and distraught and there's blood all over his white shirt. And the nurse is like, what's his name? What's the kid's name you brought in? And Jeff Bridges just can't register what the nurse is saying to him. And then he finally looks at her and he just screams at her, I don't know his name. And then it cuts to these creepy credits.
One of my favorite openings to any movie. I used to watch that opening to that movie repeatedly, studying the way that the camera was. That was one of the first times that I think that I had seen in a film, you know, when they reduce the shutter speed so the film has that, like, very immediate, very rushed look. That's very
right.
You know, it's one of the first times I think I ever seen that in a movie, and I remember just being very on edge and making it feel very visceral. And you're right, when he screams, I don't know his name, it's the ultimate nightmare, is to be presented with, you know, a kid who's blown off his arm and you don't know who he is. And it's a fantastic, fantastic opening. So,
right. I will say about Arlington Road, the significance of Arlington Road is there is no way that movie could have been made after 9/11.
No. Yeah,
it's
a miracle that it was made when it was made, all things considered.
It was like, honestly, it was the...
And it's a direct, you know, it's a direct response to the Oklahoma City bombing as well.
Exactly.
We don't want to spoil the ending for anybody who hasn't seen that film, but it really is shocking that movie got away with what it got away from. So we'll just.
It's so good. Yeah. Okay. And then I'll go into my number four. My number four is The Big Lebowski. One of my favorite scenes in cinema history is the dude driving in his car, smoking a joint, listening to Creedence Clearwater Revival's, looking out my back door, and Jeff Bridges just loving life and banging on the roof of his car along with the bass beat of that song, and just driving down the road without a care in the world. And then it cuts to the wide shot of him going down the alley when he drops the joint in his lap and he's pouring the beer that he's drinking at the same time in his lap, and he just hits the dumpster.
It's one of the funniest things of all time.
I just remember seeing The Big Lebowski for the first time on video. I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it on video for the first time, and I just couldn't believe the film. It was one of those films that I watched where it was, you know, I atone it to the first time I watched Network, I couldn't believe what I was seeing on the television. I was just like, oh my God, I can't even believe this is a movie. This is just one of the greatest things I've ever seen, and I feel that way about The Big Lebowski. I have watched that movie more than I've watched most movies, and I laugh out loud every time, and I love every small detail. Like you said, when he's at Ralph's, and he's got his robe open and his guts hanging out, and he sniffs the creamer and takes a sip, and then writes the check for 67 cents with his Ralph's. The only thing he has in his wallet is the Ralph's card, and then he looks at the TV with his, like, Ray-Bans down, and it's George Bush on the TV saying this aggression with Iraq will not stand. And he just, like, he nods with the TV, and it's like, right on, man. And then he repeats that line later in the film. Everything about that film, from fucking Ben Gazzara playing Jackie Treehorn to Sam Elliott, and dude, I could talk. We got to do this on a podcast because I'm getting carried away and I don't even give a fuck. But the scene, how's the smut business, Jackie? I wouldn't know anything about that, dude.
It's one of the
pad of paper.
Yeah, the pad of paper is one of the funniest things ever.
And not even to mention John Goodman, John Turturro, Steve Buscemi. Tara Reid's even amazing. Philip Seymour Hoffman gives one of his best performances as Brandt in that movie.
Sick.
David Huddleston is The Big Lebowski. Oh, man. That's just one of the... Okay, so that's my number four. Okay, moving into number three is The Contender. That was Bridges' fourth Academy Award nomination. The guy was nominated... He's been nominated six times. And he's only won once, and that was for Crazy Heart. But, I mean, the guy has been around for a very long time, since the 60s. And then the 70s is when he came into prominence, and Thunderbolt and Lightfoot got his first nomination, Last Picture Show. But anyway, The Contender is one of my favorite political films of all time. And Jeff Bridges plays, you know, I think Martin Sheen from The West Wing is the best fictional president I've ever seen. Or Henry Fonda from Failsafe, but Jeff Bridges as Jackson Evans is one of the greatest things I've ever seen in a film dealing with how a fictional president's portrayed. Because the entire film, he's kind of like this bumbling guy that I think you can see dudisms in Jackson Evans, like how you brought up the shark sandwich. And the scene with him and Christian Slater where he keeps offering him half the sandwich, and Christian Slater's like, no, I'm good, no, I'm good. And you think Jeff Bridges is kind of like this, not a dope, but he's just kind of like this really nice guy, and he just loves that he's the president, and he can eat whatever he wants at any time, and he gets a kick out of it. And then he says to Christian Slater, you're not going to break bread with the president? I mean, I love it. And then the end of the film where he's addressing the Senate and he completely calls out Gary Oldman's character in front of everybody and points at him is one of, like, that was a moment in cinema where I wanted to stand up and fist pump at the TV.
Yeah.
That's how good it is. I mean, he brings the house down in that movie. My number two is a tie. I'm going to go with True Grit and Crazy Heart. I think those two performances
go
hand in hand. Right, and it's interesting because Crazy Heart came out the same year that A Single Man did. And as much as I love Jeff Bridges, and he's my number two actor of all time, I was a firm supporter of Colin Firth winning the best actor for A Single Man. And I thought that Colin Firth gave one of the best performances that I've ever seen in A Single Man.
Me too, yeah.
And everybody knew Jeff Bridges was going to win because the guy had been nominated 4 times before, and it's kind of like one of those Oscars where it's like, all right, here, we fucked you over before. You're such a great actor, so here's your Oscar for, you know, your achievement and your art. But, I mean, Crazy Heart's great. It's not as great as I wanted it to be when I first saw it. I've watched it a bunch of times since then. I really enjoy the film. And the interesting thing is, when True Grit came out, I absolutely loved that film. And I thought Jeff Bridges gave one of the best performances of his entire life. And the ironic thing was that Colin Firth won the actor for A King's Speech that year, when I thought that Jeff Bridges should have won for True Grit. So, I mean, maybe one day down the road they'll switch Oscars. But I love both those performances. The Coen brothers, I mean, I can't say anything that hasn't already been said about them. They know how to make films. They really know how to cast their films and get great performances. And I love that Jeff Bridges gave two of his best performances in a Coen brothers film that are two completely different characters. I mean, they couldn't be more different, but kind of the same in a way. But yeah, so that's my number two. My number one is The Door in the Floor. You know, Jeff Bridges has played the villain twice in his career, in Jagged Edge and The Vanishing. And it's not very often that Jeff Bridges will, you know, I said this when we talked about the film, where he'll play a vicious character. And I think that's exactly what he is in The Door in the Floor. I think he's more subtle than he is in The Vanishing and Jagged Edge. But I think what makes his performance in The Door in the Floor so great and so unique is it's a combination of his affability, yet how vicious and fierce he can be in some small scenes, where his affability outweighs the viciousness in the performance, but the viciousness is so stark that you don't forget it, and you know it's there. So, yeah, those are my top five for Bridges. So why don't you get into your top five Basinger?
Yeah, number five is going to be her memorable performance in Curtis Hanson's 8 Mile. I thought she was really well cast as this trailer trash mother to Eminem. She had some great scenes with Michael Shannon. So definitely thought she was, again, well cast there. She always expresses vulnerability very well for me. Number four, 9.5 Weeks. One of the sexy movies I saw early on when I was younger, when I shouldn't have been in watching sexy movies in the basement by myself. I'll never forget her in the movie. She's supremely hot. It's just the way that it's going to be.
Let me ask you before you go on. All right, who's hotter in that movie, Kim Basinger or Mickey Rourke?
Not sure. Could be.
Okay,
could be a tie. Could be a tie. They really do. That movie, I'm not exactly sure what the reputation of that film is these days. That movie is, in my opinion, way more sophisticated than I think people gave it credit for being. And again, I don't know what the reputation is, but I recently saw it.
Everybody needs to go just shut the fuck up about 50 Shades of Grey, and they need to go watch 9.5 Weeks.
Exactly. Number three, Batman. That was just a huge moment in my life. I was 9 years old when I saw Tim Burton's Batman on the big screen. Just one of the life-changing moments for me is, in terms of cinema. And I had a huge crush on her in that movie.
Yes.
Just terrific as Vicki Vale. She was perfect. So I can't, you know, she'll always be Vicki Vale for me. I'll always think of her in Batman, just because for so many different reasons. Number two is her work in The Door and the Floor. Painful performance to watch at times. Very intense, very internal, very sad. Does a lot without speaking very much. And, you know, those eyes, she's able to communicate a lot with those eyes and her mouth and just the way that she, you know, just the way that she holds herself in a scene, which sort of plays into my number one pick, which would be L.A. Confidential, Curtis Hanson's L.A. Confidential. Two movies, at the very least, that she worked with him on. I don't know if she was in anything else with him, but I just loved her performance in L.A. Confidential. It was a huge movie for me as well, seeing it in the theater. Well, probably two or three times back in the day with 97. And she's just fantastic as the hooker with a heart of gold in that movie, and her various relationships with all the, you know, the men in that movie are fantastic and layered. And she brought that same vulnerable, hard bitten, broken down quality that she's done in a variety of movies. And, you know, she'll, for me, LA Confidential is top notch.
Excellent list, Nick. Yeah. We pretty much have all the same movies on there, except for one.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and start. All right, I'm going to preface and say that with Jeff Bridges, we should have mentioned honorable mentions of The Last Picture Show and Thunderbolt and Lightfoot and probably his whole filmography. But anyway, we're going to go into Kim Basinger.
Yeah, he's also amazing also, in Wild Bill.
Right. God, that movie's good. Also, what I was going to say is I haven't seen it in a long time since I bought it on DVD, but Kim Basinger's in The Informers, which is based on a Bret Easton Ellis novel that reunites her with Mickey Rourke, and John Foster is also in that, too. And I can't remember if they have any scenes together, but I was going to try and rewatch that prior to the podcast, but I just didn't have time to. So anyway, my number five for Kim Basinger is Wayne's World 2. And yeah. I love
I was tempted
the Wayne's
to put that
World
on there.
Movies. And, oh my God, her in Wayne's World 2 is like, it. Her. I almost think her in Wayne's World 2 is better than Christopher Walken in Wayne's World 2. Because she's just, you know, she seduces Garth, and she's so sexy because she's Kim Basinger. And the scenes between her and Garth are my favorite scenes in the movie, and it all comes down to the dialogue exchange of her being like, Garth, I'm going to be frank. And then Garth being like, well, okay, I'm still going to be Garth. And it's just, you know, it really doesn't add much to the film, but it's just this amazing... It's this amazing achievement that they got Kim Basinger in Wayne's World 2 to play the sexiest woman alive that seduces Garth.
Yes, I agree.
It's just, it's great. My number four is Batman. That was the first film I saw in theaters when I was 4 years old. I still remember seeing it in theaters. My mom took me to go see that. Batman has had, you know, that film has had such an effect on me throughout my entire life, and as I've gotten older and, you know, seriously started watching film and analyzing film, Batman will always remain as one of my favorite films of all time, one of my favorite characters, and you are just dead on with Kim Basinger in that film. I like to credit Slave Leia in Return of the Jedi and George Lucas for teaching me about sexuality and being attracted to a woman. But, you know, man, when I think about it, Kim Basinger and Batman, I just, oh, there's something so just, God. Anyway, before I get too creepy and weird talking about Kim Basinger, I'm going to segue into my number three performance, and that's 9 1/2 weeks. So if you thought I was getting weird about Batman, I mean, Dude, 9.5 weeks. I didn't see that film until probably 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, I kind of liked the erotic 80s thriller genre with, you know, Fatal Attraction and Body Heat and films like that. And I don't know, I just never really got into it. And I always liked Basinger, and I always liked Mickey Rourke, and I hadn't seen the film, and I was with my buddy Peyton, who I watch movies with all the time, and he's like, dude, somehow 9.5 weeks got brought up, and he's like, dude, have you seen that? Oh, you know what it was? It was, I bought Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and he hadn't seen it, and I was like, dude, you got to see this movie, and he's like, well, let's watch it, and I'm like, yeah, it's kind of one of those movies you need to watch by yourself, and... And so he watched it, and he loved it, and he's like, have you seen 9.5 weeks? And I'm like, no, I haven't. He's like, dude, you need to see 9.5 weeks. He's like, I don't know what's going to get you harder, Kim Basinger or Mickey Rourke. So I was like, all right, this sounds awesome, because I love Mickey Rourke. And I think I ordered it or something, and I watched it, and I was just completely blown away by it, man. And I mean... You know, it's not even the sex scenes, because there's really not, when you think about it, there's really not too many sex scenes, but the film is just so erotic, and man, Kim Basinger is just like the greatest thing I've ever seen in that movie. And you know, so is Mickey Rourke, and I think people need to watch this movie, especially all the people that are getting all, you know, I can't even tell you. I haven't seen 50 Shades of Grey. I really have no interest in seeing 50 Shades of Grey. And when somebody tells me to read the book or go see the movie, I automatically think they're an idiot. And I don't want to sound like too big of an asshole here, but, you know, 9.5 weeks is the originator of that. I mean, fuck, man. Mickey Rourke's last name in that movie is Grey. I mean, come on now. So essentially what I'm saying to the people, whoever's going to listen to this, is this is the original 9.5, or this is the original 50 Shades of Grey. Just don't even bother with 50 Shades of Grey. If you have any some sort of like burning interest inside of you, just don't even go see that movie. And you just need to watch 9.5 weeks, because 9.5 weeks is the greatest erotic film of the 1980s. Maybe Body Heat's a little better, but Body Heat's a better movie, and it's more of a film noir. But, I mean, 9.5 weeks is just, yes. Just everybody go by and watch 9.5 weeks. Jeez. I'm going to move on to my number two right now. My number two is L.A. Confidential. Everything Nick said is dead on. That's what she won her Oscar for. She's great in it. She's the hooker with the heart of gold. I mean, I love her and Russell Crowe in that film. I love their relationship. I love the dialogue that's written for Basinger. And it's so much more than the dialogue. It's her physical acting. And I think that that's her strongest suit. Not that she can't deliver dialogue well. She can do it in a fantastic way. But... Basinger is really reliant upon her physical acting. And, I mean, when I think about that movie, there's a couple scenes that come into mind, but when I, you know, the first image that comes into my head is Basinger in that kind of, what is it, like the cloak or the garb she's wearing with, like, the hood and her eyes and the way she looks at Russell Crowe when they first meet each other. It's just fantastical. And my number one for Basinger is The Door on the Floor. I think that this podcast probably, you know, anybody can take from it that this is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's my favorite Bridges performance. It's my favorite Basinger performance. She's just so heartbreaking. And, you know, you watch the film and you just want to, like, you just feel so bad for her. And it's like I fall in love with her in the film. And I know I shouldn't. And, yeah, so that's my Basinger top 10. So, or top five, I should say, but yeah.
And it's interesting too, 'cause I wanted to throw one out, one more. I was wondering if you were going to say anything. Have you seen The Getaway?
No, I haven't, with Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, the remake?
I have not.
Which was nowhere near as good as enjoyable as Peckinpah's, but I thought she was good in that one, too. I like that. I maybe should have thrown that one on my list as an honorable mention, but she never got the credit, I think, that she deserved at times. You know what I mean?
Right. I agree with you. I think of the film Cellular, which really isn't that good of a movie, but I watched it. It's with like Jason Statham and William H. Macy.
Big fan of that one.
Chris Evans, maybe?
Yeah, Chris Evans is the lead. I like that movie a lot. She was very good in that.
So.
Well, good stuff. Yeah, I mean, as always, covering good stuff and giving people lots to go out and look for. So. Next week, we are going to discuss a movie that Frank has just had the opportunity to fall in love with, and a movie that I've been obsessed with now for a year and a half since it's come out, pretty much. Ridley Scott's The Counselor, a film that many, many, many people did not like, but that a few very passionate people seem to love. So we're going to get into that movie next week's show. We're going to do top five performances from Brad Pitt and Cameron Diaz, both of whom are in Ridley Scott's The Counselor as featured actors. And we will have some other surprises for you as well. We'll see what's going on for, you know, a current topic. We'll see what the releases are for next weekend and what Frank and I can get a chance to see. And other than that, Frank, you got anything else to add? Are we good to go?
I just got to say that I'm supremely excited to talk about The Counselor, because that's a film that I bought when it came out on Blu-ray. I didn't see it in theater, and you told me that we were going to be doing that, and I was like, all right. And the other night I watched it, and I was messaging you the entire time how much I love it, and then I'll watch it again, and I'm going to watch it tonight, and I'm going to watch the director's cut tonight. I can't even tell people how great this film is. It's just, holy fuck.
Yeah,
I just can't believe I didn't go see this in theaters. And
I had to see it twice. And I would have, if I had the time, I would have seen it again. It was only out in theaters for 2 weeks in Connecticut, or 3 weeks tops. So I didn't even have a chance. I wouldn't have had a chance to see it a third time. But I saw it twice in the theaters, and I was just completely mesmerized from frame one. So we'll have a great conversation next week about that for sure. So.
For sure, and I should have the I'm buying the screenplay by Cormac McCarthy on Amazon. So I should have that read like 5 or 6 or 10 times by the time we record our next podcast. So, yeah, I'm not going to gush too much about it now. I'm going to wait. You know, I just want to say real quick about the film, though, The Counselor, that I said this to Nick like 4 times, and I said it to Gary. I wish I could just fuck the screenplay. That's how amazing it is, and... I mean, I know that the performances are amazing, and I can't believe it's a studio film, and everything about this film is amazing, but that script, man, and, you know, people who know Cormac McCarthy are just, you're just going to want to rub it all over yourself. It's that good. So, anyway.
Well, it'll be a fun show next week for sure.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, man, thanks everybody who listens, and... special thanks to Gary from last week, and I can't wait to drop this one, and I can't even wait to record next week. I'm super excited about everything. So that's all I have for episode 8 of Podcasting Them Softly.
8 episodes down, man. Lots of fun. Lots more to look forward to.
For sure. Thanks, everybody, for listening.